Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Glenn Block. I'm a program manager on the WCF team, and I'm going to talk to you about web APIs. And really, what I'm going to talk to you about is changes that are happening in the industry and what we're doing at Microsoft to make it easy to build solutions that adapt to those industry changes. So we see a couple of trends over the last few years. We see this move from websites toward web APIs. So if we look at this slide here, you can see that I've got LinkedIn, Groupon, Yelp, Twitter. These are all these social sites, but they also have this API component that allows them to be programmatically accessed. That's actually really good for me because I have a lot of complaints. Recently, as I was preparing for this talk in my hotel, my internet wasn't working really well. So because of the fact that there's these APIs, that means I can broadcast to the maximum number of people my discontent. This move, though, what we just saw in that first slide was a whole bunch of social sites. It's not only about social sites. So we have companies like Best Buy and Comcast, for example, that have been moving to expose a lot of their internal functionality over the web as well. For example, Best Buy launched a catalog service a little while back that allows third parties to come in and integrate deeply with Best Buy, looking at their catalogs and actually going through business processes, not just about sending a message, but actually creating orders and things and going through fulfillment, et cetera. Then we have APIs like Bing, which allows me to access my search or my other kinds of information from my Bing profile. And of course, Bing's not the only one that has done this. Google does this. Lots of other sites out there are doing this. So why are we seeing this shift, though? Why are we seeing this shift from just having websites where I open up my browser and I go to that site to web APIs? One thing is we've seen this tremendous influx of devices and the drive to be able to talk to all these different devices. And as a consumer who carries a device, I want to be able to access the functionality I need wherever I am. In order for that to happen, you've got to be able to talk to my device. I remember back in the days when we had like those Capro PCs, like the first mobile PCs. Anybody remember those, the Capros? It was like a suitcase, right? Not going to carry that around. But I might have my mobile phone with me, I might have my iPad with me, or my Exo with me. So basically, if you want me to be your customer, you've got to meet my need. And then we also have seen this influx of migration toward the cloud. Lots of companies are looking to take their stuff so that they're not managing it on-premise. We've got many players in this market. We're in this market, Amazon, VMware, just to name a few. We're trying to enable customers to take their stuff into the cloud. And as people are moving things to the cloud and they're no longer on-premise, that ability to be able to access those capabilities from systems, not only from browsers, becomes really, really important. So when we differentiate between websites and web APIs, basically what we mean is that a website is really being used by a human. A web API, however, is not being consumed directly by a human. It may be serviced up to a human. It may be running in a browser like some JavaScript that is running on a client that's running with jQuery, which is an awesome new web framework we have out there. But ultimately, it's code that is consuming that information and deciding what to do with it and how to present it. And it may not just be a browser. It could very well be devices. The Comcast example, what they do is they have their API exposed through a browser, and they also expose it to a cable box. So two devices using the same thing. The ability to reuse is simplicity. It means developers' jobs are easier. But there's other huge benefits, which I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking about all of them, but one of them is that the web was designed to be inherently scalable. Right? Why does the World Wide Web not go down when 10,000 people come and hit your site? Well, because there's lots of proxy servers and intermediaries. The whole web architecture is about intermediaries. Many of you may know this, some of you may not. And the advantage is, if we play by the rules, we can leverage that infrastructure for free. When the only rules that you go by are, when the only way that you travel is SOAP, you can't actually leverage those benefits. Why? Because SOAP tunnels everything over a single HTTP method called POST. And when all those servers that want to help you see that, they just get out of the way and say, okay, I'll let you go all the way across the universe of the internet to your destination server. I'm not going to help you. But if you come at me with a GET or give me some additional information, sure, I'll say, yeah, I have that. As a matter of fact, I just got it 30 seconds ago. So there's no reason for you to have to make that hyperwarp across the universe to your origin server to get that. So that's why we're really seeing a lot of this interest in building out all these web APIs. It's devices, it's flexibility as an individual to get things when I need them, and it's the scalability benefits that I can get. This is why Best Buy is doing this. They're not only doing it for enabling third parties to be able to consume their APIs, they want to leverage the infrastructure of the web for free. What's common about all of these things, all of these services, is they have a URI. Why? Because they're exposed over HTTP. The lowest common denominator, any device that you can get today, you can pretty much guarantee it's going to talk HTTP. And if it's going to talk HTTP, it's going to be able to consume URIs. So it stands to reason that if I want to have the maximum reach, I want to expose myself over HTTP. How do you do that? Well, this is where developer platforms and things come into play. And at Microsoft, we're really committed to offering a great solution for exposing your capabilities over HTTP. And we're not religious about it. And what I mean by that is, when you start to expose things over HTTP, there's a real gamut of how you can do things. Some of them have this word REST attached to them. There's a lot of people that are very interested in that. Comcast is interested in that. Best Buy is interested in that because of all the scale that it promises. But you don't have to be building things in a RESTful way to surface them over HTTP. It's all about trade-offs and decisions. So we want to offer a first-class experience for allowing you to talk over HTTP. We want to take you from your original destination, which might be SOAP, might be any other types of protocol, MSMQ, whatever it is. And we're not saying that we're getting rid of those things. Those things have their place and they're important. But if you want to play in this world, you need something that's a lot more flexible and open. And so we're committed to delivering on that, and this is really what WCF Web API is about. It's about enabling you to build solutions that play well for the web. Over the next hour, we're going to spend the time just really diving in. We're going to move away from the slides here to just looking at our new web API, how it works, what the experience is. And the things I want you to think about is when we're designing this API, the kinds of things we want to allow you to do is, one, we want you to have first-class access to work with HTTP. Anything that you read that the spec says you should be able to do, we're going to let you do it. Any type of device you want to talk to, we're going to let you do it. And we want to offer a simple experience. So keep those things in mind. You can call me out there at the end and tell me, you know, Glenn, you said it was going to be simple. That's not simple. Okay, so let's dive in. So the first thing is, when we look at HTTP and we look at HTML and specifically, there's a lot of evolving standards. It's not standing still. We just saw a presentation in the keynote about IE10 and the work we're doing there. We know that Chrome, Firefox, they're all pushing vehemently to embrace all these new standards. For us, we have the new HTML5 labs. And the HTML5 Labs is really just a way for us to experiment and explore these evolving standards and decide if we want to support them or not. These standards play well with web APIs. So let's take a look at how they play well together. So one of the things that you would have seen if you attended the did anybody here attend the HTML5 talk where they showed WebSockets? Yes, okay. So actually, before I jump to the code then, one of the really exciting standards that really is getting a lot of energy around HTML5 is this thing called WebSockets. And why do I have these planes here? Because WebSockets offers a really fast experience in the browser, a really quick way to get data. And you can use it for a whole range of options. One of the things that we've seen in the HTML5 talk was how it helps with social gaming and chat and things like that. I don't know about you. I don't build those kind of apps, right? I worked at Microsoft. I've been in Microsoft for 5 years. Before that, I spent a lot of time building enterprise applications and other kinds of line of business back-end apps. So does this technology have a use when I'm starting to think about web APIs? And I think the answer is yes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a sample of how we can put web APIs and WebSockets together. So throughout this talk, we're going to be using a very simple application. It's not a game. I'm not pretending that this is like the best app in the world. It's a contact management application through a browser. So one of the things I need to do in a contact management application is I need to add contacts. So this particular app, which is a completely client-side jQuery front end, talking to web API on the back end. So the web server here is only serving up an HTML file, and from that point on, jQuery and the JavaScript, et cetera, takes over. Why would I have a web API for this? Because I also want to have other consumers that are not just taking JavaScript. So here I can go and I can add a name like Paul Batem. Oh, switching. That is a sore spot for me. I'm always forgetting to switch. Paul Batem. And when I click Add, if everything is working here, it should. OK. Why is that not working? Oh, I opened the wrong sample. That's why. It's not supposed to work. OK. This one is the one I want. Okay, so see that little message, WebSocket connected? That means I'm in the right application. So this means I can now have a richer experience. So if I go now and add Paul's name, we see that Paul Batem, oh, all of them came back. Yeah, they were actually going, they just weren't coming back. Okay, that's kind of interesting, but I'm just in a single browser. Yes, that's true. But let's go here. Let's do a little. Do the Hanselman trick, which I didn't do as elegantly as he did. So let's go here and let's add something. Let's add Rob Eisenberg, who might be in the audience. So over there you see Rob Eisenberg. Over there you see Rob Eisenberg. Two different browsers. As soon as I did that add, immediately the other browser got updated. This is just one example of how I can take the WebSockets functionality, and this could have been, you know, multiple people having access to a shared directory. And as soon as that directory changes, if I happen to be on the page where it changed, automatically the update happens, and I don't have to do polling, because that's the key thing that WebSockets is enabling. It's bringing an event-based notification model to the client. So I'm just going to show you quickly what the code looks like for this, just so you can see how it works. First, we have the client. You guys see that okay? So in this client, one of the things you'll notice is that I am wiring up. It's completely client-side, as I mentioned. And if I scroll down, you'll see this setup WebSocket function. And in this setup WebSocket function, I'm actually opening a WebSocket. Now, one of the things you'll notice there is this if block. So with one of the things we did with our HTML5 prototypes is we allow even browsers that don't support WebSocket today to use Silverlight just to offer up the experience. So that's what this if block is doing. It's saying if you natively support WebSockets, just use it. And if you don't, but you have Silverlight installed, we'll use Silverlight. But what you can see here is the nice event model. I've got on open, on close, on message. That is just subscribing to events, and going forward, as things happen in the application, I'm going to get notified. And if I even was to put a breakpoint on it, it should work. So we'll just put a breakpoint here. There we go. I got the message. Now, one thing that's interesting here is even the initial client that did the ad, it didn't just immediately get back a response. It was more asynchronous. Let's say some type of processing had to happen. So even that first client, when I did that ad, it then got a notification that the ad actually succeeded that was then sent back. That freed up the browser to do other things rather than waiting for a response to come back. Make sense? Let's jump to see what the model looks like on the server. On the server, I actually have a class called a WebSocket service. And that WebSocket service simply has three methods on it: on close, on open, and broadcast. And basically what I do is I put those methods in. You notice that the broadcast, for example, is a static method. And then what I can do is simply have a nice model on the server for working with my WebSockets, for receiving them and for sending. You can see here I have this service.send. Now, this is a very simple implementation, and I'm keeping a local copy, a concurrent dictionary on a single machine that is tracking who the clients are. So when you think about things like REST, the one thing to think about here is REST is really about being stateless. In this kind of model, you are trading a bit of state in the sense that the server is actually actively keeping track of every person that has subscribed so that it can do those notifications. But the benefit you're getting is lower latency, instantaneous response when something happens rather than waiting to poll. And we know that polling, which is really scalable, I mean, the web, people are afraid of polling. The web succeeds through polling, not through pushes, because those servers don't know you, and they don't have to know you. But there are times when there's an advantage to have a richer communication, where I don't need my device, for example, to be sitting there and constantly polling. It just gets notified. Make sense? So this is something that we're exploring right now. We're prototyping. But we do think that it fits very well with web APIs. Okay, moving forward. Just to mention, WebSocket is currently in development, right? We're not, the IETF and the W3C are both working together, and it's an evolving draft, and we are tracking that very closely. And we're also involved in the conversations, helping to position it in the direction where it leads to. Okay, so that's enough of WebSocket. Let's move on and take a look at Web API. And what we just saw there was a very simple, a specific scenario for Web API. So what we're going to show is we're going to build that browser application that I was just showing you. And then what we're going to do is start to extend it to support other kinds of formats and other devices. That's all we're going to do for the rest of this time. And we're going to continue to show how we can keep enhancing our application to support richer requirements. And one of the advantages of HTTP is that it's actually designed to allow your applications to evolve. So the first thing we're going to do is go out of full screen. And I'm going to just up my font size. I will come back. Yep. Yep. That's too big. That's way too big. That should probably be. That's probably better. So let's create a new application. And so what we're going to start with is we're not going to build the front end. Actually, I'm not going to design the front end on the fly. We're just going to bring it in. But we're building a web API. So let's start with just building a web API. And then we will move further. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a new ASP.NET site, an ASP.NET empty web application. And we'll just call this Contact Manager. So I've just built an empty web app. And now what I want to do is I want to use WCF Web API. So there's always a challenge when we start to work with a new technology. How do we get to it? Fortunately, Scott Gu and the folks over in DevDiv have come out with this great new tool called NuGet. Any of you guys here heard of NuGet? NuGet is awesome. And so what we're doing in Web APIs is we're embracing NuGet, which is a smart decision. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a library package reference. Actually, it did not save my NuGet package settings. Let me just go add those. Yeah, I changed users, so that's what happened there. Okay, so I'm just going to go into my NuGet settings. And I'm going to add a local repo that I have, because the internet here has been pretty shoddy. It's very easy to do that. It's one of the nice things about NuGet, is that you can just work with a local folder system, so you don't have to deal with, in a demo, things going down. So when I go into the packages folder, what I'm going to see is I have a bunch of different packages for web APIs. I can pick and choose the ones that I want. I'm going to choose web APIs all, which includes everything, but we actually have partitioned it so that if there's specific pieces that you want, you can just use those pieces. And I'm going to now do install. It's going to prompt me. It automatically gets all the dependencies, which is very nice. And then I'm going to click accept. So it's just added references for me, it's done everything it needs to do, which is not actually that much, but it's just something you don't have to worry about. You're ready to go and work with Web API once you use the NuGet pack. Next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to add a global.asax. And that is going to be where I will be registering my services, which we'll see in a minute. And I'm going to create a resource. So in this case, I want to first start with exposing contacts. Sorry. So I'm going to create a contacts resource here, which is just a class. And so you don't have to watch me doing a lot of typing, I'm going to bring in some helper files, which we'll look at, so you know there's nothing in the magic hat, so to speak. I'm just going to bring in these two for now. What's in there is I have a simple POCO for a contact, which is my model in this case, because I'm going to be exposing an API for retrieving and posting, et cetera, contacts. And I also have a contact repository, which is just statically loading up some data for now, but it implements an interface. You could do a real one. My focus here is to show you Web API, not show you how to build repositories and business objects, et cetera. So now that we've got that in place, we can actually create our resource. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a get operation that is going to return a list of contact. We'll just call it get. And what that's going to do is, and we'll just do this for now, is I'm going to new up my contact repository. And then I'm just going to return repo.getAll. Now, with WCF Web API today, and we're actually looking at other things in the future, we have to do a little bit of slight annotation. And what this does is this is how we tell web APIs that you should care about this. So first, I'm going to put a service contract to say this actually is a service. The next thing I'm going to do is use what's called a web get attribute. And what the web get attribute is going to say is expose me over HTTP get. Great. We're almost done. Now, URI templates actually allow you some real richness of accessing parameters in your URI, but we're going to just leave it empty right now because we're just doing a simple get operation or get HTTP call. Next thing I need to do is to register this. Now, one of the things we heard a lot of feedback from customers about was complexity. Folks who've worked with our stuff in the past have said, you know, you guys really like giving us a nice config story, and we'd love it if you could simplify that a bit. So we've really been listening, and so I want to show you, like, just how simple the new experience is. So to get going, all you got to do is write this config file. And it's really simple. It's really flexible. You get to specify like what systems you want to work on, what OSs you want to support, what devices you want to support. It's really, really flexible. You're going to love it. Okay, I'm kidding. Though I do like that, you know, are you sure? So we've heard a lot of folks who've said, you know, we don't really like that, but we would like a way to simply be able to configure things in code. We're developers. We like to write code. That's what we do for a living. Can we actually configure things in that way? By the way, you can add additional browsers to that browser's entry, and yeah, we'll support any browser. So what we've done is, in .NET 4, we looked at ASP.NET and the routing mechanism and said, hey, what if we could just integrate with the routing mechanism and get people out of having to deal with config files. We've gone a little bit further with that in our new web API. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to do routing dot and I'm going to call a method called map service route, and I'm going to pass in my contacts resource, and then I'm just going to give it a URI of contacts. Yep. Oh, sorry, route table. There we go. So once we've done this, that's all I need to do to get my contacts resource online. So let's run it. Notice I have no browser yet, but that's okay. So let's open up our friendly Fiddler. If you don't know what Fiddler is, you definitely should if you're building web APIs. It's a great tool, free tool, for monitoring HTTP traffic. And you can use it for actually generating and actually invoking different types of resources that are out there. So I'm going to use our request builder, and I'm just going to go to contacts and say execute. Okay, so I got back some XML. So right out of the box, I was able to simply query this with XML. Now, XML is interesting, but in this new world of web APIs, there's a lot less XML and a lot more JSON. And HTTP actually provides a way to ask a server what type of format, the types of formats that I would like, and can you help me? And the way you do that, actually, is using a header called accept, which what I'm writing here. So if I put accept application slash JSON, you can see that I'm actually now getting JSON back. So I didn't have to do anything, though. I didn't have to do any special type of configuration. I just created my resource, created my route, and boom, there you go. I'm able to now query this thing. And I could expose this now over a web API if that's all I wanted to do. But what about the browser? So if I'm building jQuery-type applications by default, and if I want them to run on the largest range of devices, then I need to support more than JSON and XML. Because browsers, by default, when I click post, they actually support something called form URL encoding. Well, we're going to make that work as well. So I'm now going to copy a couple of other things in, some jQuery scripts, default page, not that configuration file, as much as I love it. That is happening. It's a little cameo for the help viewer. I guess it was feeling wasn't getting enough attention. Copy. There we go. Okay, so what I've just done here is I've added a jQuery front end. And that jQuery front end is actually going to query all the contacts on the client as soon as the browser opens up. And that it's also going to integrate with the resource going forward for things like actually updating. So here we can see now that my front end is actually pulling back JSON right into my browser, which works very well for these jQuery type scenarios. But now I need to post. And the browser, by default, is going to use form URL encoding. So let's see what happens here. So now what we're going to do is, on our contacts resource, let's actually add a method that will respond to an HTTP post. So I'm going to add a post here. I'm going to accept a contact. And then what I'm going to do is we're going to move that out. Just create a field for our contact repository, which for now we'll just new up. And then we will call directly against our repository for both methods. So I'm going to call repository.getAll. I'm going to call repository.post. And I'm going to pass my contact. And then I'm going to return my contact. Now I need to tell Web API that this is a post. So I'm going to set my URI template and set my method equal to post. So we'll run the application again, and now we'll try to add a name. And now I see that Paul got added. But let's see what's going on under the hood there, because how do we know that it's actually how it's sending things? So we're going to use, so with Fiddler, if you want to monitor local traffic in Cassini, you use 127.0.0.1. There you can see we have contacts. Let's add somebody else. We'll add Rob again. Okay, we see Rob Eisenberg came there. Uh, And now, if we look at our request, it's not showing up in Fiddler. It's doing form URL encoding. So it's allowing me from my browser, natively using the protocols that browsers understand, just to click post, and my web API works with it. So now I've got a web API that's open to non-browser clients and browser clients. I didn't have to do a lot of work. I didn't have to configure the specific types of formats that were supported, because out of the box, we support XML, JSON, form URL encoding. What do you guys think? Cool? Now, one of the things we've also heard a lot of feedback on in WCF is around testability. And when we were building out our web APIs, we also said, if we're going to be offering a first-class HTTP experience, you need to be able to do whatever you want with HTTP without actually having to go through a lot of pain. So as an example, right now, when I'm creating my contact, that's just returning a status 200, which is OK. But if you read the spec, when you do a create, you should basically return a status code of created or accepted. And they have different meanings. So I might want to return a 201. I might want to return a 202. So how can we actually, and why that's important, for browsers it may not be as important, but let's say I'm a non-browser client, and I'm designed to work with HTTP. I may be expecting that you say that you support HTTP. You're going to play well by the rules. So what we can do here is, in order to get access to working with HTTP directly, we can change this post from returning a contact to actually returning a new thing that we've introduced. We're bringing a set of HTTP APIs in that let you work directly with HTTP, but still work with objects as well. So you don't have to throw out objects and just fall to bytes. So the way that works here is I'm going to go now to my contact, and I'm going to add an HTTP response message of contact. And now, instead of returning a contact, I'm actually going to create a new HTTP response message of type contact. Once I've done that, I can now set the status code to be status code of created, and I can return that response. But it's not only allowing me to access the status code. Let's say I want to actually work with headers, like I want to be able to leverage that caching we were talking about and set caching headers and things. That object exposed in a strongly typed way headers. And then from those headers, I can do things like set age, set accept ranges, set caching controls, all this stuff in a nice, strongly typed way. And I'm not having to choose between using objects or using messages. So I'm getting to do exactly what I want to do. Another advantage of this model is that it's actually easy to unit test against. Because in a unit test, and I can also actually get an HTTP request message of contact if I want to actually access the request information. So here, once I've now changed this, you can see that my contact itself, which is now not a contact, it's a contact request, also has access to headers. So I'm not limited, like, hey, I want to get a contact, but I also want to work with these headers. Why do I want to get a contact? Because I want to support that richness of formats where whatever the client expects to send things on, I can still handle that. I don't have to push that into my code. That is part of what we think is simplicity. Not forcing things in your face, giving you the ability to do what you want to do, when you want to do it, and not making you go through a lot of pain to get there. We're just touching the surface. I'm going to go a lot further. Now, I mentioned unit testing, and I'm guessing some of you might have seen how I was newing up my repository. That can be a little bit problematic when I'm trying to write unit tests, because that means that my real repository has to be present the time when I'm writing the test. So simplicity is also making it easier for me to test things the way I want to, not having the framework stand in the way of testing. So first off, we've seen these request and response messages. Those are actually testable. They have no dependency on WCF, no dependency on a networking stack if you knew them up and you use them. You can just create them any way you want to, send them in unit tests, get the responses back, and I'm going to show you that. And I'm running out of time. So here we've got this contact repository. I'm newing it up. That's not ideal. What I'd actually like to do is use an IOC container to provide me that repository as a constructor dependency. We've always allowed you to do this in WCF, but you had to, you know, have your secret decoder ring to figure out how to do it or rely on some guys in the open source community to create something. Well, we've heard a lot of feedback from folks who said, make that easier. We're making that easier. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go back to my library references. My favorite IOC lately is one called AutoFac. How many people here have heard of AutoFac? Yeah, so the guy who created it, I used to work with him on the MEF team, Nick Blumhart, and it's just a very elegant, simple-to-use container, not to say that others are not simple. I don't want to alienate all my friends in the open source community, but I really like AutoFac, and I think the cool thing about open source is to each his own. I get to choose what I want, and we're embracing that as well within web APIs. So you don't have to use AutoFac, you don't have to use MEF, you can use whatever you want. I want to use AutoFac, I'm going to use AutoFac. So I'm going to change this contact resource here to take in a contact repository. And now I'm going to set this.repository equal to the repo. Great. But there's one problem. How do I actually configure my IOC? So let's pop back to our global.asax here. Let me just make sure one thing is set up. Tools. Snippets Manager. No, it's not set up because I changed my machine. Okay, this will just take 1 second. Snippets. Excellent. So now in my global.asax, the first thing I'm going to do is configure AutoFac. This is the easy configuration of AutoFac. I've said, here, I want to use AutoFac's container builder. I'm going to register a contact repository, register a contact resource. Great. But how do I get WCF to actually know about that container? So what we're doing is, in this map service route method, you'll notice that it actually accepts this thing called an HTTP host configuration builder. So we're going further with the configuration. It's not only about routes. We're saying that everything that you want to do, you should have a nice way to be able to do it in code, and that code should actually be reusable. I shouldn't have to write it for every single app. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to new up this, I'm going to use these helper methods on HTTP host configuration, and it offers a, drum roll please, Fluent API. And for those of you who are not familiar with a Fluent API, it's an API that is designed to make it nice for expressing what you want to do without having to deal with all the details. And it's also designed to lead you down the path rather than you just having to look at a massive API. So I want to set an IOC container. So for that, we actually have a thing here called a resource factory. So I can call set resource factory, and I notice that it accepts two lambdas. I can create a class and reuse it if I want to, but I can also use a nice lambda. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to create a lambda which takes in three things: a type, an instance, and an HTTP request message. So if I wanted to actually access the request to look at the URI to figure out how I'm going to get things from my IOC, I could do that. Let's see, did I do that right? Let me just look at that one more time. Type instance context. Yes. And now once I have that, I can go to my container and I can say, I can resolve a service. Passing in my type. Why doesn't it like that? Resolve method candidates are. I'm using the wrong. There we go. And then for the second lambda, which is actually there to actually release the instance, I'm going to just not do anything. As a matter of fact, I think we allow you to leave it null. Let's see if that actually works. So now that I've done this, if I run my application, I should be creating that resource, and it should be getting the repository that I've registered passed into it without me actually, where the IOC is actually doing the construction. Oh, I didn't pass the config. Good point. Yes, I need to pass the config for that to work. So then in my registration of my resource, I can go now and pass that config. Now, this is a script style of configuration. There's other approaches you can derive from the configuration class, create your own reusable one, which you deploy throughout your environment. There we go. Breakpoint hit. So I plugged in the IOC that I wanted to use, got my repository created, good to go. And the release instance doesn't accept null, but that's fine. We see that it actually went through the process and did the creation. All right, so that is just the bare basics of getting going. So we can see that we can get going easily. If we want to do testability and use things like IOC containers, we can use them. One thing to point out is WCF is not requiring you to depend on any static APIs. So everything that you want to do related to HTTP, you can access that request and that response either as a parameter or a return value. So we're not going to get in your way. And then with an IOC, you can use that to get your own code out of the way to make it more testable. What do you guys think? Now we're going to move into more showing and less coding. One of the things about HTTP is it's not limited to the three formats we saw. It's not limited to XML, JSON, and form URL encoding, but those are three very important formats. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of formats. This is just some common ones that you may have heard of. Some of these are things that your browser understands, things like HTML. Some of these are things that devices understand, things like text calendar or text directory, which text calendar is a way of pushing calendar invites down to a machine. Text directory is a way to handle pushing electronic business cards down to a machine. But actually, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's actually a lot. So there's a website called IANA, the Internet Naming Authority, and that's where these public media types get registered. And you see that print is small. So I went and scrolled through this list and did an estimate of how many just under the application section of IANA there are. There's 900. There's thousands and thousands of media types that are out there for different purposes. And so if you're a device and you're talking to a service, if it understands that media type, that particular media type that the application that you're using in that device is running, you can have a richer experience. When I give you XML or JSON to a device, all that says is, I'm parsable. Try opening a mail program and pulling in an XML. If it's just an XML, that program is going to blow up. Or it might ask you to map with a wizard. Well, I don't want to map with a wizard, especially on my mobile phone, every time I'm doing something. So if I can talk these formats, I enable a whole richer world. One format that we've actually been putting a lot of energy in is a format called OData. How many people here have heard of OData? And OData is a way to be able to query data issue a data query, and you can do it from a device, you can do it from a browser. Well, one of the things we're going to support in web APIs is the ability to plug in OData. As a matter of fact, we're going to make it work out of the box. It doesn't work out of the box yet. And let me show that actually working. So we're going to now switch gears to a different application, which is a little bit more fully formed. This was the Contact Manager Simple. Let's go to the Contact Manager Advanced. Let's run it, just like we've ran before. So what I want to do is, I've got this contact information, but if I can return that contact information in OData, then I can allow customers to actually query it. So the first thing we're allowing you to do is to take the OData URI format and support it for anything, not just OData. You'll be able to even write your, and I'll show you how we can use that. So if we go into our service here, before I run it, you'll see that my contact resource is actually returning an iQueryable of contact. When I return that iQueryable of contact, that's a convention that says to us, I want to support that OData URI format. Great. So if that's the case, can I go now and issue a query on my contacts to say, get me the top one? Let's see, is that working? Nope. Just, I think that's the wrong browser. Let's open. Let's try. Okay. Let's try that one more time. There we go. So I've queried my contacts, but I'm only getting them back in XML. Right? Or I can go like top equals 5. But what I really want to get is get that information back in OData. Well, I can now go to my contacts and go below it and specify a URI extension of OData. Oop, that will blow. Oh, it actually showed it. Let's go view that actually in Fiddler so we can see it. Let's use top equals 3, just to show you that there's nothing under the magic hat. So we can see we're getting back OData. How did I plug that in? That's the question. So we want to make it really easy for you to plug in any format that you want to. So if we go back to that page there, you'll notice that off of that Fluent API, in addition to be able to setting things like a factory, I can actually do things like add formatters. So formatters are a way of saying, I want to support other things than XML, JSON, and form URL encoding. And it doesn't have to just be markup-based. Like, you could say, oh, but OData is really like XML. Yeah, of course you could do that. What if it was not XML at all? This is a demo I've done before, but I'll just show it just for the sake of argument here. So I'm going to go to my contact, choose contact slash 1, and I'm actually going to put PNG. So that same resource that returned OData, I'm going to a different resource, but it's getting me back an image. And just to show you that it still supports other formats, because yes, I did change the URI, I'll now go and say, give me JSON. Same URI, now I got JSON back. So this is showing that evolvability of the web coming into play. I didn't have to change my contact resource. So now you're going to want to see what those formatters look like. Does it look like that config file that we saw before? That's going to be the key question. here's my contact PNG formatter. So the first thing I've done here is I've said, this is the media types I support. I support image slash PNG. That's so if I come with headers, basically what will happen is the server knows how to do what HTTP says it should do and negotiate and say, ah, you're asking for image PNG. I have that. I will give it back to you. But you also, and if we look at the method, it's really simple. I've got an onWriteToStream method and an onReadToStream. I get the instance of the model that was returned from my operation, or the model that's being sent. I can go both directions. I can handle representing things any way I want to, either direction. And what I decided to do here, which is kind of silly, is I pulled out from the contact the identifier, and then I use that to find images. As a matter of fact, if we run that app again, you'll notice on this version of the app, I actually have images of every contact. But every one of those images, if you look at that link, is just going back to that same resource and getting the representation that it wants. Now, that raises a different question, which is, how is it mapping from the URI to giving me what I want with accept header? Because I'm not putting image slash PNG. I'm just putting PNG. Well, part of us offering a first-class experience, as I mentioned, we want to let you do whatever you want to with HTTP. I showed you one way of doing that within the operation. We're also introducing a pipeline model that lets you do that outside of the operation. So the way that I'm handling these formats is actually pretty cool, I think. We have another extensibility point that we're adding, which you can see is surfaced right on the Fluent API here, called message handlers. Message handlers do one very simple thing. They sit in the middle of the request and the response, and they manipulate it. And if you do it at the right, and what it allows you to do is have full control. Before our upper level framework that starts to map things into objects ever even looks at it, you can change things around. So the trick that I do is I created a special handler which allows me to pass in a mapping. And you can see below in the code here, I'm mapping XML to application slash XML. I'm mapping JSON to JSON, PNG to PNG, et cetera. And then if I look at my extension, my mapper, my extension, what I actually do, and this is also very easy to write, if you've ever worked with WCF channels, there's a lot of stuff you have to do. The only thing I have to do here is implement a send async, and I get access to those HTTP requests and response messages. So I can do some async processing. What I'm doing here is I'm mapping the URI. If I find that the piece that you put in maps against the table that I built up that maps the accept headers, I'm literally replacing the URI, ripping that out, modifying the accept headers so that it looks like you sent me the accept header. Because that really is the way HTTP works. HTTP only knows about accept headers. It doesn't know how to take a URI and map it to a particular representation. Those URIs are just bookmarks. But this gives me a very clean way to handle both, and I didn't have to go through a lot of work to make it happen. You guys like that? The last thing that I want to show is, so far, so we've seen images, we've seen markup, but there are all different types of formats out there. I mentioned that devices understand. And there are formats out there that other types of applications understand. So one of them is Gmail. Gmail actually understands a format called vCard. Anybody here ever heard of vCard? vCard is an electronic business card. And the beauty of it is that if I can give it something in a vCard format, it doesn't have to have me map it in any way. It just knows, okay, you're a contact, and how I know how to map all the information from this standardized format into my Gmail format. So to do that, we go to this import contacts, and you see here it says browse a CSV or a vCard. Well, in Windows, when you browse, you can actually go to a network URI. It doesn't have to be actually in the file system. So I'm going to browse, and I'm going to go take that URI that I have here. If it lets me get to my browser. Why is it not letting me get to my browser? Because the dialog is open. Good point. I'm going to take this URI here, and I'm going to go back to this Gmail thing, and I'm going to browse here, and I'm going to put contacts, and I'm going to specify that the format is VCF, which is the vCard format, and I'm also going to do a query and say filter it and give me, let's say, the top three. That's actually not what you think. It's not an error. The way the Windows system works, it does it multiple times. So we're going to go now do an import here. And we're going to say put that into a new group. We have imported three contacts found in the uploaded file. So I just showed how integrating with Web API, I was able to now have a rich interaction with Gmail off of a Web API service. I think that's pretty cool. And this is just touching the iceberg of what you will be able to do. Okay, so the last thing I want to just quickly say before we go is, where can you get this? We actually have a site that we launched at PDC called wcf.codeplex.com where you can get the source. We're about to push live. I meant to on stage, but we don't have enough time to do it, but I'm going to do it right after. And you will be able to get those NuGet packs. So you will be able to get started on this right away. There's samples, there's unit tests, there's even acceptance tests to show how the samples work so you can learn them. So basically, and as a recap, we're really committed at Microsoft for offering a solution for building applications for the next generation that can leverage this new web-based world. We'll also be talking a lot about how that plays out in the cloud in the future with Azure and with App Fabric. Thank you very much for coming.